Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour program on news, politics, human rights, and the environment. TalkNation.org for discussion. I'm Dori Smith. Con Hallinan is a lecturer in journalism at the University of California and an analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus, FPIF.org. His articles frequently appear in Counterpunch, where his November 5th piece documents the U.S. military's violations of the Geneva Conventions in Iraq. Con Hallinan joins us to talk about his November 14th piece in Counterpunch, titled Provoking Syria, Cambodia All Over Again. Con Hallinan, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Let's go over your November 14th piece on Syria.
Mm-hmm.
You say that the United States has been unofficially at war with Syria. What kinds of military actions has the U.S. taken there?
Well, there have been two types. There was one major firefight in which U.S. troops, saying that they were in hot pursuit, crossed the border into Syria and apparently got into a firefight with Syrian border guards and killed several Syrian border guards. There have also been reports, and fairly well-established reports, that the U.S. is infiltrating special forces across the border into Syria. So these really constitute military clashes. I mean, at least in the one case, the administration is not at all denying the fact that it did get in a firefight with Syrian guards. It was on the Syrian side, and that Syrian soldiers were killed. It comes pretty close to war.
Now, what are some of the arguments that the Bush administration has used for bombing along the Euphrates in western Iraq and these kinds of cross-border tactics?
Well, the standard argument here is that the insurgency in Iraq is the result of foreign infiltration, that these are basically the result of jihadists coming from Syria, coming from other countries, etc., infiltrating into Iraq, and that's the basis of the insurgency. Now, it simply isn't true, and the United States actually knows that it isn't true. Both its own intelligence service has found that 95% of the attacks in Iraq are by native Iraqis. Only about 5% are the are foreign fighters. Most of the suicide bombings are foreign fighters. So what they're saying basically is that Syria is allowing, deliberately as a part of the policy to destabilize Iraq, that Syria is allowing these jihadists to infiltrate across the border, and they're the ones that are causing the trouble. Now, we know that they're not causing the trouble. Are the Syrians allowing them to do this? It's an enormous border. Syrians don't really have the capacity to seal off that border. But even if they did seal off the border, it would have virtually no effect on the insurgency in Iraq, according to our own intelligence. So that's the main kind of issue. Now, there's also a sub-issue which has to do with Syrian interference in Lebanese internal affairs.
And has the United States closed off the border with Syria or worked to close off the border with Iran previously, or
no.
Has this been left alone?
This is pretty much left alone. We don't have the troops. If we put all of our troops, and there are, I think, 153,000 Americans right now in Iraq, if we were to deploy all of those 153,000 troops, which is silly because a lot of them are support troops, along the border of Syria, we might seal it off, but probably not completely. Of course, wouldn't have anything for the Iran border. What we've done is that we've told the Syrians they're responsible for sealing it off. Now, the Syrians opposed the American invasion of Iraq. They are certainly not our allies in the region. The administration has had a studied policy of hostility towards Syria. It's talking openly of regime change. It gave an interview to the Financial Times in which it said that they're already discussing who they're going to replace Assad with. that they're favoring a military coup at this time. So if you're Syria, you know, you're not going to expend a huge amount of money trying to seal off a border, which you probably couldn't seal off in any case, and which you know is not the source of the insurgency in Iraq. And because everyone in the region knows it's not the source, then the fact that the Americans keeps coming back to it makes the Syrians and pretty much everybody else suspicious that this is simply an excuse to go after Syria. That's probably a pretty good guess.
Now, we're talking about some of the same players who brought us to war in Iraq. Let's go to the discussion that you have entered into about National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley,
right,
who you say is in charge of the Syria operation.
Correct. Correct. Well, of course, as National Security Advisor, he would be in charge of any kind of thing like regime change. And, you know, Hadley is a guy whose fingerprints are all over the run-up to the Iraq War. Hadley was the guy that basically put together the evidence for, or the lack of evidence thereof, the made-up evidence, that Iraq was buying yellow cake from Niger. And as we know, that got into be quite a scandal, and in fact, the whole legal fallout with former Ambassador Wilson and the present charges against Libby from Vice President Cheney's office, etc., all come back to that point. So this is a guy who not only played an important role in the run-up to the war, but he seems to be a tad inefficient at this business, and a lot of people are apparently in trouble right now because of him. But he's central to this whole operation, and he's part of the particular crew of neoconservatives around Vice President Cheney that have been the major pushers for not simply the war in Iraq, but also for destabilizing Syria, and increasingly for beginning to intervene in places like Bolivia, Paraguay, etc. It's a very aggressive section of the administration. I would have to say this. I mean, there's a caveat here. I think at this point the administration is split on this question. I know that the military rolls its eyes and trembles when it thinks of some kind of military operation in a place like Syria. It's falling apart in Iraq, and I think that the recent uproar around Representative Murtha talking about immediate withdrawal from Iraq, what that's around is that he's got the pipeline into the commanding officers, not the top officers, but the colonels in Iraq, and they're telling him, if we don't get out of Iraq, we're going to lose this army. I mean, it's going to be, we won't be able to recruit for another generation. It's just going to be a disaster. So I think that Hadley represents the Cheney wing, which is, unintimidated and unimpressed by the disaster in Iraq, and is willing to add more fuel to the fire.
You write, too, that the strategy reminds you of Cambodia policies. So talk about that aspect of your piece, and do so in terms of the possible grotesque failures that could occur if the U.S. military does continue toward regime change.
You know, again, to remind people, I keep forgetting that, I'm 63, and so to me, the kind of details of the Vietnam War are, they sort of what I grew up with and was in the middle of. For most of my students, I might as well be talking about the Battle of Antietam or Gettysburg. I mean, these are things that are just enormously far into the past. So just a quick reminder, April of 1970, the Nixon administration was arguing that the war in Vietnam in the South was being fueled by troops from the North. Now, in fact, there were North Vietnamese in South Vietnam. This was a civil war. But that all of the insurgency was the result of infiltration from Cambodia. There was a particular area called the Parrot's Beak that sort of jutted out into near the Mekong Delta in South Vietnam. So the United States and the South Vietnamese Army crossed the border in April 1970, preceded by a massive B-52 bombing. The invasion was a failure, I mean, because the war in Vietnam was not fueled simply by North Vietnamese infiltration. It was unsuccessful in terms of seizing the North Vietnamese headquarters, but what it did was that it destabilized the Cambodian government, and it led to a coup in Cambodia. Sihanouk was thrown out. A military government came in, and the Khmer Rouge organized against the military government. When the Khmer Rouge got in, well, we know about the killing field. So the connection between one and the other is an absolute direct connection. Now, in terms of Iraq, a lot of us argued, you invade Iraq, you are going to open the lamp. You have three communities which live in a tense relationship with one another. The possibilities of a civil war are present, and not only would a civil war destabilize Iraq, but because Iraq is a very central country and a very developed industrial country for the Middle East, that it's going to have impacts all over the place. The Turks are going to get involved because of the Kurds. The Iranians are going to get involved because of the Shiites. The Sunnis are going to get involved because Sunnis are a minority in Iraq, and Sunnis are a majority in the Middle East. I mean, it was just domino after domino was going to go. Well, they went, and of course, all the dominoes have fallen. And it's not that there's a danger of a civil war in Iraq. There is a civil war going on in Iraq. In fact, the best way to end that civil war is for the United States to get out. So the reason I use Cambodia is that, you know, it's sort of this, you take an action and you don't bother to study history, or you don't care about it, and then you're surprised by the results. I think the results of invading Syria would be to destabilize not only, of course, Syria, but it would certainly cause the Kurds in the northern part of Syria to ally themselves with the Kurds in Iraq. This would freak out the Turks because they do not want a Kurdistan established in their southern border. It would certainly destabilize Lebanon. The view of Lebanon that we have now is that everybody's anti-Syrian. In fact, Lebanon's pretty much split right down the middle. People seem to forget that it was the Syrians that went in and ended the civil war in Lebanon. And the struggle in Lebanon is certainly, you know, it's a long-running one, and it has to do with Christians versus non-Christians. And Christians have always dominated the politics of Lebanon. They're the most powerful, the most wealthy sections of the society. I mean, these are complex things. In comes the United States with F-16s and M1 Abrams tanks and thinks they're going to make things better. Well, they always succeed in making things a lot worse. Cambodia was a disaster. 2 million people dead from the killing fields. You know, we're still picking up the pieces from that in Southeast Asia. So my feeling is that, you know, this talk of kind of going in and resolving things by military force, which is what people like Dick Cheney and Bush and this particular section of the Republican Party want to do, has proved disastrous in every case. And I would say that the same thing is in Afghanistan. I mean, I think we talk about the fact that, you know, Afghanistan and now has an elected government and everything. You know, it's an incredibly dangerous place. The Taliban are making a comeback. You know, you can't solve things with guns. Let me just say one other thing, too, and it's the continuation of the big lie, and I don't know how else to put it. 2 days ago, Vice President Cheney, in his speech to the American Enterprise Institute, said that if the United States withdrew from Iraq, what it would mean that al-Qaeda and Zarqawi and these jihadists would now have a state that they were in control of. Literally, not a single person, not only in the Middle East, but even in Iraq, thinks that's the case. How could 5% of the insurgency seize control of the other 95%, given that the other 95% is far better armed and far better organized? It's it's this continuation of the lie, and it's getting an astounding number of people killed. I mean, I think one of the things that people don't think about here is that they talk about the American casualties, and these are awful, and they're terrible, and there's, I don't know, it's 15 or 16,000 now wounded, and, you know, certainly more than 2,000 dead, et cetera, but nobody talks about the Iraqis. And there's no agreement on how many Iraqis have been killed. The Lancet British medical magazine says that the figure is 100,000. Other casualty organizations that have been tracking it say it's somewhere between 35 and 39,000. Hard to say. That's why when I see these people talk about Cambodia and I see someone like Murtha talk about Vietnam, these people know what they're talking about. Murtha fought in Vietnam. He saw what we did, and he saw the consequences of what we did. And, you know, he's pulling on those consequences.
About Representative Murtha and his argument that the U.S. military presence in Iraq is making things worse, I want to call your attention to an interview that Amy Goodman did on Democracy Now! With Colonel Wilkerson. Now, he worked in the Secretary of State's office under Colin Powell, and it just so happens that she showed the video of the speech you're referring to with the Vice President's comments to Colonel Wilkerson, who then commented on them. Now, I want to say that this is someone who's become extremely controversial in his remarks about this White House and the fact that he's saying that there's a cabal running the government at the top level. He said that the tactics that the United States military has used, including torture, have really caused a problem in terms of how the United States is perceived in the Middle East now, and in terms of any possible competition we might be in, where winning hearts and minds away from extremists might be concerned. So he's saying we're losing the war of ideas. Just comment on that part of what he said, and talk about this split, again, that you've mentioned in the government.
Well, I think in terms of losing, I think we've already lost. I mean, I think that one of the things that was interesting is when they found a couple last week, when they uncovered this prison that was being run by the Internal Affairs Administration of the present of Iraqi government, and there was signs of torture and all that kind of stuff. When the Americans made a big thing of it, if you take a look at the editorials in the Arab world, and not just in the Arab world, in Europe as well, you know, people just laughed. They just rolled their eyes. They said, what are the Americans complaining about? You guys gave them the idea. We don't have any moral support, not simply in the Middle East. Look at the last vote on Cuba. A resolution came up in the United Nations against the embargo. We had four votes. One of them was Israel. The other are Palau and the Marshall Islands. Total population, 97,000. That's how isolated we have become. And it spread beyond the Middle East. When the subject came up of the embargo against Cuba, the Organization of American States not only voted against the embargo, they changed the term from embargo to blockade, to stop the blockade. Now, that someone says, well, that's a piece of vocabulary. It's not a piece of vocabulary. An embargo is the policy of a country. A blockade is a violation of international law. So here's the Organization of American States, what we normally think of as our backyard, basically accusing the United States of violating international law. That would not have happened without the war in Iraq. That would not have happened without Abu Ghraib. It would not have happened without this cabal of people who have seized control of the Department of Defense, the Department of State, and the leading executive positions in the country. I mean, you know, the whole thing about Judith Miller that got sort of missed here was that what you were really seeing was that you were seeing the leading newspaper in the country, one of the leading reporters for the leading newspaper in the country, basically acting as a conduit, a stovepipe, as it were, for this phonied-up intelligence to the American people, in a sense, the New York Times has such a big impact on other newspapers and radio stations, television, etc. You know, it's really our only national newspaper. It has an impact far beyond its circulation. And there's no question, since Judith Miller was in the meeting with these people and having meetings with them in the midst of them, she knew what was going on. It's very scary. And the thing that makes me worried about it is that under normal circumstances, you would say, the United States invades Syria? Give me a break. You know, they're falling apart in Iraq. How are they going to pick up something else? These people don't worry about that. I mean, this doesn't enter their minds. You listen to Dick Cheney now. They are just as tough and as aggressive and unilateralist as they were. Right now, John Bolton, 2 days ago, made a proposal for reform at the United Nations, which basically concentrates all power in the hands of the General Secretary and the Security Council, and completely, I mean, the General Assembly basically becomes a debating society. This is what the administration has done to internal politics in the United States. When Condoleezza Rice was asked whether or not the Bush administration would come back to Congress to ask them if there was a possibility for military actions against Syria and Iran, she said, no, that wasn't necessary. The Congress had already given the president the right to do anything he wanted under the war of terrorism. Therefore, you know, the right of Congress to declare war is simply gone. And these are the people that are right in the center of it, and I find them a very scary group. And, you know, again, not to go too farther afield, Donald Rumsfeld and the leading people in the State Department, the Latin American desk, say that the present crisis going on in Bolivia, with demonstrations, everything like that, is being organized by the Cubans and the Venezuelans. Well, you want to put that argument together with the pre-Iraq arguments that the administration was coming up with, and these statements about Syria and Iran being these centers of terrorist operation. Yeah, I think this is all very scary. It doesn't make any sense, but it's all very scary.
I do want to ask you about the changes that we've seen in Iraq in the last day or so, with recent announcements being made, ironically, really, that there may be some agreement being reached between Shiites, Kurdish leaders, and Sunni leaders where it pertains to a withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is a story that has legs all over the world and none in the United States. And that is that the Arab League called this conference, brought together all of the parties, just like they did in 1989 in Lebanon. And the Syrians were asked to go in by the United States and by the Arab League, and they ended the civil war. This is a very important development. Now, the United States has done its level best to downplay this conference going into it. I mean, they didn't have much choice afterwards because this resolution came out. If you look at yesterday's New York Times, there's a story which buries the conference in the 11th paragraph on the inside page and gives it two paragraphs. All over the world, people have been looking at the Arab League conferences and really as a way out. This is a way out. This is a way that could end the situation going on in Iraq right now. When Chalabi came to the United States last week, he gave a speech to the American Enterprise Institute. The whole focus of the speech was to try and undermine the Arab League's efforts, because it's not in the interest of Iran, it's not in the interest of the Shiites to have this kind of agreement. Chalabi represents that section of the neocons. He represents Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and, you know, Hadley and Firth and all of those people, and John Bolton, etc. So the administration has done its best to undermine this. I think this is extremely hopeful. I think that the Arab League meeting is a breakthrough. And I think this begins to also bring in outside pressure. that to step away from unilateralism. For instance, one of the things that this resolution is going to do, it's going to put a tremendous pressure on the British. Tony Blair is already fighting a rearguard action against opposition to the deployment of the troops. It's going to be very difficult for the British to resist giving a timetable for the withdrawal of their troops at this point. I think it's a very, very important development.
Now, the last time we were reading about Iran, we were learning what the IAEA was doing and an evaluation of the possibility that Iran had violated the Non-Proliferation Treaty was going to be put off until, I believe it was November 25th.
Right.
And so where we left off was this sort of higher-level debate. However, you've written in your recent piece, November 14th, that's published in Counterpunch, about MEK, an organization of Mujahideen-e-Khalq.
Mujahideen of the Flag.
And so this is an extremely nationalistic organization, I would assume?
It's a very odd organization. It's a really odd organization. It would be kind of hard to describe them. And I guess if you had to describe them, you'd say, well, they're kind of culty left is the way I would describe them. They carried out a number of bombings in Iran. After the takeover of Khomeini, they have been, some of the information that they've given has been accurate. Some of it has been, sort of tarted up. It's hard to tell what it is. But they are officially a terrorist organization. That is, they're on the State Department list as a terrorist organization. And we're basically protecting them in northern Iraq. So there are some contradictions here that are pretty impressive. Now, one thing you did say was, what about referring Iran to the Security Council for violations or proposed, suggested violations of the Non-Proliferation Agreement? That apparently has been now put on the back burner. I suggested this in a column earlier. I wrote a column about the vote for India to possibility of referring Iran to the Security Council, but the U.S. has now backed away from that because they can't get support from anybody in the Security Council. The Chinese, the Russians, and the Indians have told them that they have no intention of referring Iran at this point to the Security Council. Question is the Iranians building nuclear weapons? Well, that's a different interview. It's a long and complex one.
Okay. Let's talk, though, about the presence of this Mujahideen faction near the Iranian border itself, because we're now looking at a completely different world with events in the United States splitting, as you said, the U.S. government really wide open for us to look at from a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
But who would be supporting this kind of development? Maybe it's a covert operation in part, maybe not, but...
Well, it's a little of both. The Mujahideen, that particular group, has gotten very strong support from the neocons. I mean, it's a very uncomfortable support because the Mujahideen kind of consider themselves sort of quasi-Marxists. And so, here are these quasi-Marxist types hanging out with Dick Cheney and Hadley and Wolfowitz and these people. And so I would imagine small talk at cocktail parties must be short. However, the Mujahideen, their support comes from the Department of Defense. And in fact, the U.S. State Department has always been rather nervous about them. But the Department of Defense, which is Rumsfeld, they're very supportive of them because they see them as a potential kind of fifth column.
Con Hallinan lectures in journalism at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He's an analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus, and you can find his work at Counterpunch. We'll be hearing part two of the interview with Con Hallinan tomorrow on Wednesday's usual edition of Talk Nation Radio. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. This program was produced in the studios of WHUS Stores, radio for the people at the University of Connecticut. TalkNation.org for transcripts and discussion.